We are in Tempe, Arizona, at the Education Innovation Summit, put on by Arizona State University. We're with Bob Bowen, who's executive chairman, former CEO of Scientific Learning Corporation, was at the Education Prize Advisory Committee meeting we did at the Salk Institute lately. Here we are at another event talking about the problem, the education problem. The challenges on the program, at least here, are how do we educate in a rapidly changing world? How do we focus information and technology to produce meaningful change? Did you see any signs of hope in what you've attended here and any sense of optimism about this?
Well, the hope at this meeting is that clearly there are a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of innovative ideas at both the post-secondary K-12. I don't think we heard as much from the corporate learning world, but and there was a lot of investors here who have lots of money to deploy. And what you can see is there's enormous interest again in the whole area of education globally. So it's not just in the U.S., it's a global phenomenon. And so I think that's the reason for optimism. But I would say that the dialogue here could have been enhanced. What's missing from this discussion is the scientific side of the discussion. So a number of those panels would have been greatly benefited by hearing from research and what's going on. And you notice here, there's no discussion. There is a fundamental belief in education that we can solve all of these opportunity, access, and learning issues either through better teaching, better curriculum, better standards, better assessment, better data. But we know that for just one variable, the mind and the efficiency and preparedness of that mind to take advantage of this is a big deal. We also know the deployment of technology in a very different way than was even discussed here. The main discussion here was about how to use that technology to deploy current approaches to learning, not new approaches. I mean, they would say it's a new approach to learning, but so it would have been broadened, I think, if we had engaged the world of science, particularly the practical aspect of science. So you know, if you get too far out in the research, then I think most of the audience couldn't have engaged. But I think it would have been enhanced. The other way it would have been enhanced, there were representatives here from the higher ed institutions. Okay, there were no representatives here that are engaged in the operational, practical side of K-12 education. And my view is there should have been. So, for instance, at our panel, if you'd had a Joy Wise here, who's fought the battle of urban education, could talk about that in a very different way. That so we talked about the issues of civil rights and education as a civil right, which I agree with 100%. But Joy could have talked to you about the practical aspect of that and why it is so imperative and what could be done, and there is a lot of hope, but things need to change. So the conference was great, and it does point toward a lot of hope, a lot of innovation, a lot of money being invested and spent. But I think the dialogue would have gone up even another octave if we had just engaged the scientists and also had some what I call real operational innovators from the educational K-12 educational institution.
Yeah. Now, we at our last meeting focused on a couple of areas that we thought would be tractable to the kind of approaches we were talking about in terms of an incentive-based, innovative right. approach to education. One was the 0 to 3, essentially, preschool. The other was 8th grade to 9th grade transition. And the early group, the very early childhood group, is obviously one that you would look at as from a neuroscience perspective,
Absolutely.
Cognitive neuroscience. I think that the 8th to 9th grade transition, although it could be looked at as being a market-driven remedial scholastic opportunity, I think there's also a lot to be said about looking at the neuroscience application there in terms of teen brain and so on and so forth. So I think both of those, making your point, the injection of really good neuroscience into these troubled areas is essential to raise the game and to be able to sort of get some sort of a grip on this enormous problem.
Yeah, there's no question in my mind, either one of them. So you can take the younger kids. We know from the research that's being done at Rutgers and other universities. So we have this baby study. We already know by 6 months of age, we can predict with really good accuracy.
This is April Benesich's
study. This is April's study. We know that we can predict with really good accuracy the kids that are going to have language acquisition problems. Those are going to be reading problems. Those are going to be the kids that are going to struggle. And it is not unique to a demographic category. So we know. And we know that those kids are going to have difficulty. We also know that that can be altered. Okay. So the sooner we get that, the better this child is going to be able to take advantage of whatever educational opportunities put in front of them. Mm-hmm. The panel, and there is truth to this, so I don't deny this, that the one of the panels there that was dealing with the civil rights aspect of this, particularly the Reverend, believed it's all about the lousy quality of teaching and et cetera these kids are being exposed to. And some of that is absolutely true. But it's also the child's preparedness to take advantage of the educational opportunity. And so if we could catch that earlier, there would be a lot less pain and I think a lot more success. So early is great. But we also have kids now moving through the system and clearly the society is once again focused on these dropout rates, which are atrocious. Yeah. And it's worse than that, because that shows you just how bad it is. But a lot of kids are graduating, right? They're graduating, but they're not really prepared for the world of work, prepared for higher education, prepared for training. In fact, the armed services won't take them. So the armed services is picky today. You know, they won't, because they're highly technological, right? And they want people who can operate all of this fancy technology. So. And clearly we know that 8 to 9 year range, there's enormous change going on in the brain, the adolescent's brain.
Right.
But on top of that, we know we still can enable massive change there that would allow them, even though they may not have gotten as much out of their earlier education, this latter part, it would really allow them to take advantage and even close down some of that what they have lost. So I think both of those are enormously prime opportunities. But we do need to engage the communities that could really impact that. So we need to engage the neuroscientists. We need to engage the entrepreneurs. We need to engage the operational educators who are innovators. There are plenty of them out there. Not all of them, but there's plenty of them. So it's just it's a great opportunity. And if we could incent that some way, and what we've been talking about, I mean, if there was millions of dollars on the line, people would go after that and I believe create demonstration centers as a result that would show what could really be done. I still believe it's a very clever kind of independent idea about how to focus attention and increase, the pieces I believe that need to be engaged to really tackle the problem.
You mean the prize story?
Yeah, the prize. I think that prize thing is a good idea, or something like that, whether that's the answer or something else is the answer. But some way we need to engage, and then we need to incent. There may be a lot of ways to do it, but...
The emphasis on the neuroscience, though, is crucial here.
No, absolutely.
So, since we last talked, we went off to Vanderbilt. Yeah. And went to the Peabody College, had a conversation there with Camilla Bembo. And we were in state, in Tennessee, in Nashville, when the news came out that Tennessee and Delaware had received the Race to the Top awards, $500 million for Tennessee and $100 million for Delaware, and obviously enormous elation. Where do you see the administration's strategies on all of this going? Do you see success here? Do you see good movement? What's your assessment from your position?
I'm going to have to wait and see. I mean, there's not a good track record for that kind of money being used, in my opinion, wisely. I hope this will be different. I think that clearly Arne Duncan and the administration is trying to infuse new ideas and trying, but the execution, so there is a, obviously there were proposals submitted and only two of them right now have been accepted. Mm-hmm. I have no idea personally what's in those proposals. But hopefully it will be something very different. My concern is that it will not be that different. And it won't foster the kind of change and innovation that we really need. I don't know yet. I'm hopeful. I've seen instances in last year's stimulus money, I've seen instances where some school districts have done some really, they use that money to really do some different, very different things. But I've seen others who used it primarily to hire teachers that they had laid off or to keep from laying off teachers. And it's one-time money. I mean, it's not going to be repeated, and that's not going to solve the problem. It relieves some short-term pain, but it doesn't solve the challenges that we face. So I think we're going to have to watch and just see. I mean, I'm always hopeful, and I'm pulling at will. And if there at least be some centers that emerge that can really show. But don't believe it's going to foster the kind of collaboration that we're talking about.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, all right, so you're Arne Duncan for a day. What you can wave a what would you like to do?
Well,
I don't want the job. He said.
Well, if I was Arne Duncan, of course, now I've been exposed for 10 years to a body of research that I had no knowledge of. So neuroscience to me was a foreign word. And if you had asked me 10 years ago what that had to do with education, I would have said not much, right? And I'd have been more like the current thinking. I would have said, well, you know, we need more technology in schools. We need better and more immediate assessment. We need more diagnosis. We need to continue working on improving the quality of our leadership in terms of principals, school principals, and in terms of high-quality teachers. We need greater incentives. We need choice. We need all kinds of... So I would have been down...
Say something rude about school boards.
I'd have been right where kind of everybody was, because that's the way I taught and learned and believed, and there were good examples. I didn't know about the neuroscience research, and I got introduced to that kind of by accident through working with a equity company and doing some consulting work when I retired. And I got introduced to scientific learning, and I got introduced to Paula and Mike and Bill and Steve, and started studying the research and trying to learn. It was hard because I had to change the way I thought about the issues. Every time I was around these scientists, and I learned more, and I got it better. And it took time for me. It took even longer to translate it out. I don't think Arnie has access to that information. I mean, we're trying, but I don't think he has access. And so if I was Arnie, I mean, many of the things that he's doing, I'd keep doing. But I would bring the neuroscience community in and say, look, how do we make a better mind? How do we better prepare these kids? And it's not only how do we take these kids who are really struggling? That's where the money is, and that's where scientific learning's, because there's a lot of discretionary dollars in Title I and special education monies. But the fact of the matter is, when you start talking about college preparedness, and I'm going to go now compete in the university setting that is not student-centric, mm-hmm. right? Well, that's another level of competition. Well, my brain needs to be better to really compete, because I'm nobody in a big institution like ASU, despite what everybody says, I don't believe that it's student-centric. And I know Michael Crow may be trying to make it that way. You got to come in here and you got to pass these courses. And if you don't, you're going out the door. So we can not only help the kids that are struggling, but a better mind will allow kids to get into the college of their choice and to compete in that college. And really, we're talking about is take advantage of the learning, right? I mean, so at all levels, and I'm hopeful we're going to start to see more research emerging, because a lot of people now in the education world, through scientific learning and its innovations, are beginning to learn the potential that this exists. But I think many, not all, not a Joy Wise, for instance, many still see it in a narrow band. Okay, this is for kids that are really struggling, or they are kids who have learning disabilities. Okay, all right, we accept that and we'll. But the fact is, every brain can be made better. And kids that go through this that are average improve their brain. And that allows them to do even better. Kids, say, that are above average, but not up at the top of the range, they can be better. And eventually, we could build exercises and all kinds of things to deal even more broadly than we're dealing. And when I say we, I mean the neuroscience community could, right? So. And I thought the model that, you know, where you was really great, where you're dealing with the machine learning and when you develop those three tiers. I mean, it's just really true. So, I mean, if I was Arnie, I'd be engaging the neuroscience community, the practical, because there's a lot of research already been done. But how would we do this? You know, and how do we? You know, and I'd bring some money to bear in that translation, in fostering that translation, that innovation. So that'd be my.
Yeah. So in other words, realize that this is not just remedial treatment for pathology.
No,
this is the best way to go. This is it.
It's
understanding the system that drives.
Yeah. Why would everyone not want? Now, I am concerned that, for instance, people like myself who are aging, right? We all know brains are not getting, right? I mean, we know these neurons. We know the activation is not as good as it once was, and it's just like our bodies. And we do know there are people, though, as they age, there are people willing to exercise their bodies on a regular basis, which you need to do. Now, you don't have to be you don't have to do it, you know, every day, 4 hours a day, but you need regular exercise. And we know that's not only good for your body and muscle mass and bone mass, but it also pushes blood to the brain, which is good for the brain. But we also know the brain needs to be exercised in novel ways. But you got to do it. And some people will exercise and some won't. And I think we're going to face the same dilemma unless we can create innovations that, and my hope is with the world of neuroscience, we will eventually capture the gaming world and we'll build games where people, addictive games that people just do it, it'll be fun, right? I mean, they'll think they're having fun, but in fact, they are really exercising their brain in novel ways, which keeps it sharp and active, keeps their cognitive agility. I think a combination of, I mean, the brain, the gaming world, as I understand it, they know how to addict you, right? So I don't see why we couldn't build. I'm hopeful. I don't know that we could, but how we could build, good neuroscience-based exercises that are good for the brain to accomplish certain tasks into that fun activity. So that's kind of my dream. But we'll find out.
So from this particular meeting, the summary would be that you'd like to see some more neuroscience injected into this, so it's based on a research platform. You are pleased to see more of a thrust to bring innovative technologies into the arena, and I think the important point you made was the acknowledgement by a number of people, notably Chris Whittle, for example. This is a global problem. You know, on the first page here, it says 101 million children of primary school age across the globe are not in school.
Absolutely. It's global, and not only that is what the developed world, and I would think the leadership of third world countries know, but certainly the developed world is education is the engine that drives economic advantage. So the first thing we learn in the business world, right, is I don't care how great your products are, I don't care how great your ideas are, you eventually have to have people to execute, right? And the quality of your workforce and the commitment of that workforce the ability of that workforce to work towards a common goal, a common set of goals and mission is paramount. And if you can't get the right people, you're going to have limitations on what you can pull off and what you can do. But also just from an individual point of view, we can see this across Asia that, the ability, for instance, to speak English fluently, it's access to education, which is access to well-paying jobs, right? So, I mean, even more than perhaps I think U.S. Senator Jill still gets that, right? But I think we take it a little bit more for granted. And as I grew up, my parents, they preached that every day, that the key was education, right? And, you know, my granddad and my dad and my mom and grandmother would say, if you don't want to work like I work, right, if you don't want to labor like we labor, you get that education. And their thought wasn't just a K-12 education. Their thought was, you know, a college degree. And that's the key right there. Now, what they misled me about is you work just as hard, but you work differently, right? So you're not doing manual labor. You're doing other kind of labor, which you still have to work hard, but if you're going to succeed. But But they were right.
Did you imagine when they were giving you this advice that you'd end up being in this situation today?
No, I thought it was, you know, I'm like every adolescent in the world, right? I thought it was just parents shoving something down your throat, right? But as you reflect back, I mean, the two great lessons in my life, that was one, and they were absolutely right, right? So any little advantage I've got was through an education. But the second thing was they always said, you know, they always beat on me about, you know, the most important thing in life is who you decide to associate yourself with. And of course, they meant early on your friends and peers, right? Because they have enormous influence. That's that lesson. But the real truth of the matter is those choices through life are important, because if you associate with high quality people, you know, imaginative people, I mean, you know, the right kind of people, it's, you know, great, good things happen, right? If you associate yourself with the wrong kind of people, you get sucked into the wrong kinds of things, it drags you down. So, you know, you develop a great respect not only for your parents but for your elders as you age yourself, right? You're saying, man, these were really smart people. I mean, they really got it. They got what it was about, you know. So anyway, it's just
every time we meet, there's yet another cover story of something on this hot button, not going away education issue. This is the cover of Time magazine for this last week, April 10th. Should schools bribe kids? Amanda Ripley's cover story. It's a story that's slightly misleading cover line, but it's certainly a story about the work that's been done on incentives by Roland Fryer, at the professor of economics at Harvard. Been keeping up with this? And this is the Jeffrey Canada's Harlem project and so on.
Yes, they should bribe them. And I wouldn't call it bribery. They should incent them. I mean, people do what they're incented to do, right? You know, I mean, generally, they don't do it out of the goodness of their heart. I'm not saying there's not good people in the world, but people are, they are driven by incentives, whether they're, you know, whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of incentives, but kids should have incentives, right? And, well, I don't see anything wrong with incentives.
When we first started this discussion, which resulted in that meeting that we were at, the notion of should there be some kind of a prize, an Education X prize, you remember that I mentioned having first heard Peter Diamandis, the CEO of the X Prize Foundation, saying at a meeting that I was at, you get what you incentivize.
I believe that. We know that from our workforce, right? Whatever you incent, you know, two things, what you incent and what you measure is what you get. So you can say all kind of things, you can talk about all kind of things, but people are really smart and they watch, and they, you know, they watch what you do and what your actions are and et cetera versus, you know, kind of what you say. So what you monitor and observe and measure will produce results. And what you incent will produce results. And sometimes in business, we think we're incenting one thing, but we find out, no, we didn't incent what we thought we were incenting. We were incenting something else, and it's not what we wanted. And then we have to alter our incentive programs. Say, well, that's not what we want to do, and we have to refine them and change them to say, look, you know, let's incent the focus of our employee base and et cetera on the things that we're, you know, and figure out how we can get that done. And so, so I believe that. I think it's exactly right. What you incent is what you will get.
Well, we'll be going on to the next phase of this, following up on that meeting, seeing this more on this adventure about a possible X Prize in education. So we'll continue the conversation next time we meet. Good to see you, Bob.
Good to see you.